So it's a great pleasure and privilege to have a chance to talk to Maurice Bloch. Maurice, where and when were you born?
I was born in Caen, in Calvados, which is a place where I've spent 15 days or so, and that's all in my life. I have no family connections from Normandy. My family comes
What, when were you born?
1939.
Your family?
My family comes from sort of two different areas of France. One lot from Lorraine, the other lot from Bordeaux area, and Bayonne a bit further south. So I'm sort of the product of it coming together.
Tell me about the two branches, something about. I mean, what sort of occupations do they have? And
well, I mean, my father's family, the Bloch side, actually also came from Lorraine. He was a miller. No, he was not a miller. My great-grandfather was a miller. It's called Maurice Bloch, from Lorraine. But the connection, I have no connection with these people, with that, his family. I have quite a lot of connections still with my grandmother's family, who were from Bordeaux, who were Sephardic Jews from, if you go back, very, very far back from Portugal, and who were very rich in the 18th century and who declined gradually until they had no money, so they carried on trying to marry various people like my grandfather in the hope of getting a bit of money to match to their aspirations. So that's one side. They still many of them, large numbers of cousins in all around the southwest of France. The other side, my mother's family, more interesting in anthropological terms, because her father was a village school teacher in the Massif Central, but her mother came from Durkheim's family. She was the niece of Durkheim.
Really? Gosh.
And the first cousin of Moors and so on. They came from a little town in Lorraine called Épinal. It's the most boring place in France. I know. And they had this academic connection. And you know, I mean, my mother knew Durkheim quite well as a child, but I met Moore several times.
Did you?
Yes.
Really? Gosh. What was he like?
Well, he was very old when I knew him. And he was more or less, you know, towards the end of his life, he was more or less off his head. And he lived in the same block of flats or more than my grandparents, and so my grandmother used to go and take food round to him, and they used to come and tag along from time to time.
You never had any deep discussions? That was the gift with him. Right, gifts is appropriate. Tell me something about your parents as people.
Well, I mean, I never knew my father. My father was killed in the war. My father was a rather odd product, at least of his mother's family, in that he got into Polytechnique, which is, and he sort of was therefore in the French army at the beginning of the war, and he was arrested by the Germans very early on, as all sort of high army officers were, and was more or less killed very, very soon afterwards.
So you'd just been born, you were just a baby yourself?
I was a baby, yes. My mother is quite an extraordinary sort of person. She was a biologist, marine biologist. And at the beginning, immediately after my father was born, she...
After your father died?
He wasn't dead then, quite.
Oh, yeah.
She went to the headquarters of the Gestapo, very famously, to complain to Heinrich, and of course they never let her out. And she was deported. This whole story has been sort of now intriguing, been included in a couple of novels, actually. And she was sent to Auschwitz. But because she was a biologist, she was put with a number of scientists, like the outside, managed to survive, because the Germans were trying to obtain rubber from dandelions, which had latex. And so they got all the biologists together, mainly sort of people from Auschwitz, in a kind of lab nearby. So towards the end, she was put back with the others, but that was it. And so she was in Auschwitz, or near Auschwitz, most of the time during the war. So I never knew her during that time. And I was then sort of more or less adopted during the war by a polytechnic friend of my father's, who included me in his family, you know, with a false name. And they brought me up, and I remain very, very close, and I still am to this day.
What was his name?
He was called Louis Netter. So my mother came back, and then after a while, she married a British biologist called Kennedy. Who she met at the conference. And so that's how I came to England at the age of 11.
What was his first name?
John Stoddart Kennedy. John Kennedy. He worked at the Agricultural Research Council here. At which stage my mother had other children. But I kept very close to touch with my French family.
You haven't said anything about your mother's character apart from the extraordinary nature of her survival. She had a strong influence on you? Was she intellectual?
Not very much, really. She was sort of incredibly hardened as a result of her experience, and therefore not easy to have much contact with. She was. Yeah, she was very, very tough. It was partly how she survived. She'd been a mountaineer before the war, and she always sort of remained very, very tough. My stepfather had much more influence, actually, John Kennedy, on my intellectual development. So I was always interested in natural science as a result of that. Though I tried to keep away from it, having to, you know, my stepfather and mother both being natural scientists.
So where did you go to school? Where was your first
school? First of all, I went to the Lycée Carnot in Paris, and then I went to school in Cambridge, in the Peirce School.
In Cambridge?
Yes.
Which one?
The Peirce.
Oh, I didn't know you were there. Yes, tell me about the Peirce. How was it?
I didn't like it. I hated being taken to England, quite honestly. And so I was extremely uncooperative, really, in school. I mean, it's sort of,
But were there any subjects you enjoyed?
Oh yes, I mean, I was very influenced by his history teacher. I wanted to do history at university.
What was his name? Remember?
Tanfield. John Tanfield. He's a brilliant teacher. And also an English literature teacher who was a member of a scrutiny group called Douglas Brown. Both these people influenced me very much.
Were you a games player?
No, not at all. I totally had a dislike of cricket because it was English.
Anything English was out.
Yes, I quite like rugby.
Mm.
I'd be very good at boxing in France, and I did carry on to box as a child.
Mm.
So when I first came to England, I was good at boxing. My games master thought that was very, which was a good thing. And so as soon as he thought it was a good thing to have me boxing, I immediately stopped.
Contrarianus is your middle name, Maurice.
What?
I said contrarianus, it sounds like your middle name.
Yes.
And what about other hobbies? I mean, were you interested in music or art or
I was interested in all sorts of things. I sort of became very keen brass rubber as a child.
Did you?
Yes, and I was very interested in the whole history around that.
Mm.
I mean, as a tool of sort of history. What else did I do? You know, it was a kind of hobby.
Is music of interest to you?
Yes, I was sort of very regretted that I was never, I mean, I sort of very much like music, and I very much regretted that I never got a chance to sort of learn to do anything, and I sort of sing very badly.
Mm.
And that's...
Did you listen to a lot of it?
Yes.
Mm. Anything particular?
I like a whole lot of, I mean, it's basically classical music.
Mm.
Basically the sort of the standard classical music and then a few modern musicians, people like what's he called now? You know, the French composer Messiaen.
Mm.
I particularly like. I like Britten very much, John.
Mm. He's English.
Yes, that's right. No, I still like it, sort of, yes.
So you did reasonably at school, though. I mean,
fairly reasonably, just not brilliantly. I mean, I sort of just managed to get into university.
Hmm. Which university was that?
And I went to LSE.
The LSE.
Yeah. I sort of fell into it. So I was going to do history. In fact, I sort of half started in Durham, but I fell into it. As a result of various influences.
Hmm. And you changed from history into
anthropology. Yes.
Into anthropology. How soon was that?
I mean, very soon, almost immediately.
Mm. And who were the teachers in? This is the Raymond Firth year, I presume.
That's right. It was Firth. They were
It was about
Maurice
1960.
Friedman was there. Maurice Friedman was there. I mean, Firth was just ending. Maurice Friedman was there. The people who sort of had an influence on me were Firth, Maurice Friedman, Mankell, Burton, Benedict.
Yes, I
who I liked. And then also I went a lot to University College. I became quite a fan of Mary Douglas before she was really well known. Adrian Mayer I liked very much. That was towards the end of my career.
Tell me something about any of those people's character or influence on you that you think would be useful. I mean, I know all of them.
Personality, I don't know. I mean, I was very... I spent a lot of my time at university acting.
Did you?
Yes.
What sort of acting?
Oh, largely in French plays, but in British ones as well.
Had you been acting at school? Was
no.
This? No.
But anyway, of these people,
who was your personal tutor, so to speak, if you had one?
The one I remember was Burton Benedict, who was very sort of supportive.
American.
Liked him. Admired Firth incredibly. I admired Adrian Mayer very much.
Mm.
And as I say, I only did sort of once in my third year heard Mary Douglas, and I thought, gosh, this is a really interesting person.
Mm.
And in a sense, I still remember the excitement of first hearing her.
This was 3 years or so before Puritan in Danger, wasn't it?
Yes, but she already gave one or two lectures, basically, the stuff on the Abominations of Leviticus. And that was quite dramatic.
Were there any people that, on the fringes? I mean, when I was at the LSC, I used to meet people like Ernest Gellner and Ronald Dorr and people in philosophy, demography, David Glass and so on. Did any of them, did you go to any of their lectures or meet any of them?
No. Because I spent a lot of time at University College and I spent a lot of time acting. I sort of heard lectures from I was interested in linguistics, and I followed lectures in linguistics at SAAS, rather bad ones, but still an interesting subject.
So you again did reasonably, but your mind was half elsewhere.
Yes, I mean, also I was quite politically involved at that time. Both my parents were in the Communist Party, although they left very early. But that I never had anything to do with the Communist Party. But I was quite involved in via France, because I was spending a lot of time in France, with opposition to the Algerian War, before the Vietnam War and so on, and that was quite important. The sort of empty.
It was the Cuba crisis as well, wasn't it?
Yes, that was a bit later.
Yeah.
And that didn't involve me so much. I was quite sort of passionate about these colonial wars and their influence on my going to my working life abroad.
So at the end of your time as an undergraduate, it was 3 years presumably, so were you beginning to get interested in any particular part of the world? I mean,
yes, I was interested in India.
Benedict was a sort of, he was mad.
It wasn't so much his work. He was a very nice man. The person who really I felt I was really interested in was Adrian Mann. I would have quite liked to have gone on and doing the work on India. But I got the chance of coming here largely because... Cambridge, yes.
Yeah.
I only got a sort of what we call state scholarships the second year. The first year, therefore, I wasn't sure how to support myself. I wanted to go on to that stage. And Maya Fortes was setting up a massive research project with the French, with Germaine Duterna at the time. And so he said, oh, well, I'll find you some money to come as a research student here. Partly because he thought I could sort of act as a kind of bridge between the French and the British. I sort of vaguely knew him. My parents vaguely knew him. So I came and said, all right, I'll work in West Africa. I was not in the least really keen at all because my heart was very much on India. And then that whole program collapsed. I'm not quite sure what happened. And therefore he was landed with me, and also by then I got one of these research, these state studentships, they were called. So I was freer, and he said, look, all right, you can do what you like, so long as it's in Africa. because that was on that basis, got me in here, I think. And so I went to part of Africa, which was the most Asian, which is Madagascar.
So that was the reason, because it was nearest.
It was partly also, I was very, I still had a tie to history, and I knew the history of Madagascar. Madagascar is quite exceptional in terms of at least the African continent in the amount of the history one knows and the details one knows. So that was one element.
So who were your contemporaries as PhD students at that time?
My contemporaries as PhD students.
Carrie,
Carrie, I actually supervised.
Carrie Humphrey, we ought to say. Yeah.
Yes.
You supervised
her my first year as a graduate student, and she was in the last year as a as an undergraduate, and the year afterwards we were both graduate students again. It's one of the things which happens. So she became a contemporary. And my contemporaries were, I mean, the ones who were really, I knew well, I was Andrew Strathern very well, Marilyn, though she was still an undergraduate that last year, Adam Cooper. There were other people who were less well known. There was a man called Jim Farris, who I liked very much.
Yes.
He was a good friend.
Mm.
Who were the others?
There's Johnny Perry.
No, Johnny Perry came later, but we became quite friendly when he, when I came back from Madagascar and he was about to go.
Ah, right.
So we were sort of, but we became friends then already.
Are there any?
So it was quite close to Andrew Strathern. Adam Cooper, Adam Cooper, Marilyn afterwards. Jim Farris.
Are any of those people who continue to influence you, or you'd like to say anything about as anthropologists or humans?
As humans, I think all those people I've mentioned have remained friends. I'm not in very close touch with any of, I mean, you know, not daily touch. The person I'm very close to is Johnny Perry.
Yes, because you...
And also, you know, I like the kind of anthropology he did.
What, when you came to Cambridge, this must have been about 1963, something like that, 64? How did it strike you? I mean, of course you knew it from Perth. So it didn't feel too foreign or strange.
No.
Were there, of the teachers, I mean, that generation was Jack, Edmund?
Well, you see, I started off with Meyer when he was part of that project, and then when the project fell apart, he sort of lost interest in me. And I always felt that of the graduate students, they were sort of, to a certain extent, the clients of different members of the of the faculty. I mean, you know, sort of like Adam Cooper, close to the 40s, and there's a man called Jeffrey Benjamin, was close to Leach, and Andrew's close to Jack, and so on. And I wasn't really close to any of them, which I rather enjoyed in a way, partly because of Madagascar, you see. There was a very sort of antagonism between Africa and Asia, and Madagascar is really in between, so it didn't really belong to anybody. Marilyn is in a similar position, I feel, that...
Audrey sort of was partly...
I liked all those people. Yeah, I met sort of Audrey was sort of... became interested in me, and I liked her, and I think it was reciprocal.
This was Audrey Richards.
Yes. Sure, I liked all those people, actually.
Did any of them formally become your supervisor?
The person who I sort of passed through various hands. As I say, I wasn't really of any interest to anybody, until I sort of was passed on at the end was supervised by Tambi. And he, I felt, was the first person who actually understood what I was on about.
S.J. Tambaya.
Who understood Malagasy society. I was working with the Merino Highlands, sort of irrigated rice cultivators. And he was really good. I mean, you know, I would say, as a supervisor, he's the only person who really helped me in Cambridge. Though I got lots of ideas from the others.
Was there some similarity between his work in rice cultivating islands in off India?
Yes.
Or,
yes. I mean, I'd always been a great admirer of, still am, of England's sort of political system of Highland Burma, which I think is an incredible book. I also was continued to be rather independent in many ways, and began to get to know some of Lévi-Strauss's work then. I had a sort of mixture, I think, you know, to a certain extent, because I was sort of still had in the back of my mind Firth and Lillian and Mann, and the very different influences of Leach and Fortes here. And I sort of, I think my work is a bit odd in its combination of these two influences. As well, you know, sort of Marxist, French Rhine Marxist writers, who were totally unknown then in Cambridge.
Were they?
Who do you say?
Well, I was surprised that there was I mean, obviously Lévi-Strauss was known to Leach, but the Marxists were...
Not very well known. And they were beginning to publish in France.
I mean, as a human being, how do you get on with Edmund? Because he had quite a forceful character, didn't you know?
Perfectly well, yes. I liked him.
Was he?
I felt he was. I mean, for a very long time in Cambridge. I really felt that nobody was interested at all what I was doing, partly because they weren't interested in Madagascar, I think. And then at the end, they all became interested in my work. And, you know, at least Fortes, and, well, Fortes never very much, though I liked Fortes very, very much. I don't think he ever was really. But Jack and Edmund both did. They read odd chapters of mine, they made very, very useful suggestions. So the person who really helped me was Stan Byrne. And as a human being, I got on very well with them, but I was sort of slightly distant. I wasn't, I rather liked not being anybody's possession, like in a way people were certainly forced to at that time, partly because of the antagonisms between these people.
That was very notable, was it, that it was divided between the Fortes and Leach?
Yes, it was notable. But, you know, in a sense, I don't know, I was just looking from the outside. The person I think who was most bitter about it all was Jack, actually.
He was most bitter about it?
Yes, I think bitter.
Because he was between them all?
Yeah. Well, he was bitter both, but I don't know, I mean, I had a feeling he was both bitter about both Fortes and, you know, by then, and Edmund. I think he really didn't like him. I don't know, I may have been wrong.
Tell me about your going to the field. That was in your second year, presumably, is that?
Yes. No, I mean, I think I had an extra year before because of not having a grant, and so I was half working and all sorts of it.
Yeah.
About a year and a half. So going to the field, it was, I arrived in, I mean, I had made up my mind to work in Madagascar. I arrived in Madagascar with knowing absolutely nobody there, which is a very unusual situation, you know, partly because there was nobody from Cambridge who had any connections with anywhere there. So I just put myself in a cheap hotel, and after a while thought I must go find somewhere to go and study. And I found my field sites in sort of weird ways. After a while I just used to go to the sort of bus lorry stations which are around the capital and just go in any of them.
Randomly.
So, you know, because people only spoke Malagasy basically. So no, so go in one and just go. And I had some number of adventures like that. Though on the whole people were extraordinarily nice and tried to look after me.
You mean you would get in a bus and just go somewhere?
I didn't know where I was going, yes.
That's called randomized sampling, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and then I met people like indirectly like that, and I finally found the place Mm. I did field work like that. And I really enjoyed doing field work. I suddenly felt, I think the first time in my life, that I was really quite good at it.
Mm.
And that I was understanding some new things, you know, that this was different from the kind of stuff probably I'd been taught.
Mm.
I was good at them, you know, getting on with people. I was quite good at learning the language. I had the great advantage of being able to compare myself with a few totally useless French anthropologists who were around when I got to know. I knew that what I was doing was infinitely better. Mm. And so it gave me a lot of boost to my self-esteem.
Mm.
And by the time I came back to Cambridge, I felt, I think for the first time in my life, that actually I really was quite good. But I got on by myself very much.
What was the theme? What were you trying to, what was the question to which you were trying to find an answer?
Well, I mean, my interests were originally very, I was interested in economy, economic anthropology, partly, you know, from a sort of Firth background. After all, I said this was all rather boring. I was interested in kinship, you know, sort of big questions about kinship. And I did realise fairly earlier on that the Malagasy type systems were quite different from what I'd been taught. And that the focus on tombs, you know, that people define themselves in terms of where they're buried rather than who their ancestors are, was very interesting, and that was my focus.
Mm. So you let the situation shift you into a new direction.
That's right.
And did you become interested in ritual at that point? With the tombs, I suppose.
Yes. I was interested in the ritual. I mean, that was partly Edmonds' influence.
Hmm. You'd already read Political Systems and so on.
Oh, Political Systems, yeah, doesn't get much of interest in but he had written other things which were interesting on ritual.
Hmm. Was any of Levi-Strauss beginning to have any influence by that time, or not?
Yes, I mean, I could see the significance of the overall scheme. I like the overall scheme of the elementary structures. I liked, you know, I'd been interested in linguistics, and that became much more important later. And therefore, the link between linguistics and structuralism and social structuralism of Levi-Strauss meant a lot to me in a way that I think it didn't to most British anthropologists at the time.
Mm.
Partly because they had no understanding of linguistics and what were morphemes and structural linguistics and things like that. Well, I did.
Mm. Which you had taught yourself by going to lectures at
Sands? No. I did a sort of subsidiary degree in linguistics.
Did you? When? At the LSE?
At the LSE there was a subsidiary degree, you know, you could do that.
Mm.
I've been taught very badly, but I was quite very, very interested in linguistics, so a lot of it was taught by myself.
Mm. You're bilingual to start with, or do you speak any other languages, European languages? Or?
I can get on, I mean, I did German, so I can speak German, no, not very well. I'm now almost completely forgotten. I can understand Italian and get on with it when I'm there for a while, same as Spanish.
Mm. When you came back, you wrote it up, the thesis up with Tambi. Who was Edmund your internal examiner?
No. Internal examiner was a rather grey figure.
Grey or great?
Grey. G.I. Joe.
I was going to ask you whether it was G.I. I've interviewed G.I.
He was a rather nice man, actually.
He was very sweet. His widow is still alive.
Is he still
alive? Ursula is still alive, yes. His widow.
I didn't know him at all. And I had Adrian Mayer as an external examiner because I had sort of, I think they asked me, who would you like as an external examiner? So I said, Adrian Mayer.
Mm. And they liked the thesis.
He liked the thesis. He passed it. It was a time when large numbers of theses, as you probably, I don't know if you were around at that time, were being referred. So it was a great relief.
No, I didn't know that. They are again. But And then it was published?
Fairly quickly. Mm. It was published, more or less.
Mm.
I rewrote it to a certain extent, not much.
Mm.
It was published. And it was fairly well received, actually. Yeah. I mean, lots of people began to read. I think it was different. It was very different.
Was it CUP who published it?
No. I think I was saying to you, both Marilyn and I were just out. Mm. Mm. You know, I mean, nobody had anything against us, but they didn't really.
No wedge place.
We didn't belong to anybody. Mm. And people who belonged to people were put in the Cambridge series.
Mm.
And the people who weren't, like Marilyn and me, were put in this series done by Seminar Press, I think it's called, which is a branch of Academic Press.
Mm.
So both Marilyn's first book and mine were published there.
Mm. But it was well received.
Well, yeah, it was well received, and I got sort of very good reviews. You know, it was sort of really good reviews from people who didn't know much about Madagascar. They seemed to have been very interested in John Middleton, Gulliver.
Mm.
I don't know why they asked the visitor to review it, but they did. And then I began to write other things.
Hmm.
Jack had been doing that seminar on literacy, and he asked me to write to take part in it. And that was fun. I mean, Audrey Richards asked me to take part in the thing on councils.
Oh, yes. Which was, again, a Cambridge paper.
Yeah, they were Cambridge papers. And so I published both those things. Mm. And that was nice. There were sort of things. Both those articles were very, very different from what I was writing in my thesis.
Mm.
And through them, Audrey got to know my work. Obviously, Jack got to know my work, if you didn't really know it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And did you get a job straight away? Those were the...
I did, I got a job in Swansea.
For 1 year, as a temporary lecturer.
No, it wasn't a temporary lecturership, but my wife, I was married by then, and so my wife had a job in London, and so as soon as there was a job available in London, I applied and got one in the scene.
Mm. What was Swansea like for that year? Did you enjoy it?
I love Swansea. It was partly because I made good friends. And then, I was... I spent a lot of time swimming. spending large numbers of evenings cooking on the beach and...
Hmm.
I made friends with some psychologists.
Hmm.
So I very much enjoyed it. It was a bit of a... The department was sort of not all that brilliant, but I enjoyed it.
Hmm.
I liked it very much.
Hmm. But London called, so we went back to the LSE.
Yes.
What year was that? About
69, actually.
Just after I left. I was there for 2 years. And by that time, Friedman was just leaving for Oxford, I suppose.
He was still there.
Hmm.
Raymond
had retired. Raymond
had retired. It was a rather poor period in the LSE. Hmm. I mean, the LSE had I think after Raymond...
Lucy had gone.
She was still around.
And Robin Fox was just leaving.
He'd gone.
Yeah.
So
Jean was there?
Jean came at the same time as me.
Hmm.
And I got on quite well with Jean at first. I lost a bit of touch with her. Well, yeah, it was very close personally, but not so much intellectually.
Ian was there?
Who?
Ian Lewis?
He hadn't come.
He hadn't come.
Mm. He came that year.
And Peter Loizos came a bit later.
Yeah. No, he came same time.
Alfie Jell?
No, he wasn't there. He was an undergraduate student. So I think...
Mm.
I was not very impressed by the staff at LSE at that time,
mm.
but I was by some of the graduate students.
Mm.
of whom Alfred, who I knew from Cambridge before, and I was quite close to him and a few other graduate students, Olivia Harris.
Did you, I mean...
You know, I was the same age as them, you know, so I spent more time with them, and intellectually I had far more, you know. And I see, it was very, I mean, it was very, I think it sort of took a while to pick up again for about sort of, there was nobody really of great interest there, my view, until Johnny came, really.
When did he come?
He came. Six or seven years afterwards.
And Chris Fuller came back then?
Afterwards, that was quite a while afterwards. But Alfred had come, Alfred, Johnny, then, you know, things were beginning to pick up again.
What do you think of Alfred's work?
I've always thought Alfred's work is brilliant. I've always thought he's extraordinarily interesting. I think a lot of it is wrong. That's because he actually says various things. Sometimes it's terribly muddled, but some of it is absolutely...
What is the best, I mean, is it?
The best is his book on art.
The
book on time, I think, is not very good, in my view. It's muddled, it's interesting, but it's muddled. His... I think a lot of his essays are brilliant. Absolutely extraordinarily brilliant. I mean, he really is a very, very brilliant person. You know, somebody like Mary Douglas for me. you know, he's sort of among the stars. And Johnny in a different way.
In what way?
I think Johnny is... I mean, I trust what Johnny writes much more than I trust what Alfred writes, first of all. I think he is within a kind of the traditional British sociological tradition, about the best thing that's ever come out of it. Which was very good sort of doing books together, because I was never really in that, I don't think. But, you know, the push and pull of the two different approaches was extremely useful. He's also a brilliant reader, which I think is something I greatly admire in people as well, as much as they're being a writer.
By reader, you mean reading or...
Reading critically, evaluating, helping other people, and helping the understanding of people's work.
And seminar holder, I suppose.
Fantastic.
Raymond was pretty good. Quite good at seminars.
Yeah, I mean, Raymond was very, very good at seminar. Raymond is... I have incredible admiration for Raymond's work. But I don't think he's brilliant at all. I mean, Edmund had brilliant, you know, I mean, yes. That's right.
Were you still in touch with Mary Douglas at this time, or had she gone to America?
Yes, I did, on and off. I mean, you know, I hadn't been in touch with her. I mean, I just sort of admired her from afar. But then I did get in touch, and she also was very generous about my work. She got quite excited about it, and we so all her life, really. On and off, I sort of had contact with her. I was not close to her personally. I was close to Johnny personally.
This is the period when many people associate you with Marxism. I mean, Marxism.
Well, I was, yeah.
What is there any...
Well, I mean, there are two elements. Well, one of the things that you've missed out...
No, we've got plenty of time.
All right. One of the things you've missed out is that the year after I came to LSE, I was invited to Berkeley.
Ah, I had missed that, yeah.
And that's very, very important. Because in Berkeley, I again had a very good time, and made very good friends there. But the people who influenced me were not anthropologists, but linguists, mainly linguists and philosophers. And I always had that linguistics interest. and began to be really very interested in what one would call cognitive science.
Hmm.
Searle, John Lakoff, I got to know these people quite well, and what was particularly interested in their work.
Hmm.
Kay, Vernon Kay.
Oh, yes.
Began to read quite a lot of developmental psychology, and also Chomsky.
Hmm.
I mean, well, it wasn't there, but that's where I got to know Chomsky.
You got to know him personally, or?
No, well, I got to know a bit, but I got to know his work.
Were you tempted to stay in America?
No. I mean, I was offered actually a job. It was a bit difficult probably because my wife wasn't offered one. But also...
You must have been offered jobs there several times, in fact. Later,
yeah, but I'm talking about that time.
Yeah.
You know, they asked me to stay after that year.
Mm.
But no, I wanted to go. I was not very comfortable. I mean, I was sort of politically uncomfortable because, I basically was very close to various Marxist but non-communist movements, mainly in France, not in Britain.
Mm.
And also, I thought of it at one stage. Consider it. I loved going swimming. I made quite good friends. Again, as I said, basically not so much with the anthropologist. Glenn Isaac, who's an archaeologist, too.
Oh, yes.
I was very friendly with an economist called Alain de Genry, who I'm still quite close to.
Mm.
So I enjoyed those people.
Did your wife go with you?
Yes, she was, yes.
And did you have children?
Yes.
Anyway, so you came back and we got to the time when you wrote Marxism and Anthropology and other.
Yeah, I mean, that was not really... I was interested in Marxist ideas that have been all along, ever since I was about 16, really. And the reason... and therefore I knew a lot about it.
Mm.
Marxism and Anthropology is a historical book. Mm. I mean, it's about the history of the relationship.
Mm.
I knew quite well the French Marxist anthropologists, and I was very interested, impressed by them.
Maurice Scudéry, Emmanuel Terre.
Those two, especially by Emmanuel Terre. That's my doubts about Bourdieu, but that's another matter. And I knew a lot about Marxism, much more than my British contemporaries. And by then, quite a bit more about structuralism. And of course, structuralism continued to interest me, in terms of the interest in linguistics. And a developing interest in cognitive psychology, which for me were linked to the Marxism. There's a very close link for me in my thinking between a kind of naturalizing of social science in linguistics, psychology, especially cognitive psychology, and Marxism.
Did you take any formal training in cognitive psychology or psychology?
No.
I just
read and I got to know people. All these things were sort of just in the back boiler really all the time. I got to know a few people working in cognitive psychology. And then I began to do work with Susan Carey in Harvard now. She she was at MIT at that time, mm-hmm. and began to talk. I got to know Dan Sperber at that time, mm. who I've been quite close to. It's very funny, I mean, we met in a very odd way.
How was that? If you want to tell us.
yes, probably. but he, I wrote an article in which has been very often reprinted on ritual, which also contains a criticism of basically semiotics mm. and the semiotic approach, which was beginning to influence a few British anthropologists also. It really is implicit criticism of structuralism, of sort of Austrosian structuralism, called Symbol, Song and Dance, which took a long time in coming out. It was the same time as Dan Sperber was writing his book on symbolism. Mm. We didn't know of each other at all. And my article came out first. And Dan and a friend of his, a man called Smith, a Frenchman, mm. Pierre Smith, had read my article and had sort of written something which was never published about it. Sort of 200-page reply to an article, which he gave me recently. And in a sense, we're very close. I mean, so what Sperber was saying in that book and what my article was saying was very close on many points, and they both discuss other things. Mm. And that irritated both of us. And so his response was this massive thing that he was going to publish. At that time, I was sent by the JRAI his book. We didn't know each other, mm. which I criticized. And he felt he couldn't publish his article because it would have seemed a sort of tit-for-tat business. So we began to be very aware of each other, and then we met at the conference, and we knew exactly who we were, and we started to talk, and it was ever since. Mm. We've been fairly close, mm. though different.
And you say
but we did have that same combination of interests, you mm. see, of anthropology, linguistics, and cognitive science. Mm. And therefore, I think that is what influenced the similarity of our point of view. Mm.
I remember when I once met you, you were doing nearly all the PhD supervising at the LSE, or in anthropology, you seem to have a lot of PhD students.
Yes, I did have a lot. Yes, I loved doing that.
You?
Yeah, and with very different PhD types of students.
How many PhDs do you think you supervised? Any idea?
A hell of a lot.
You never counted, but...
No, I mean, I think it's something... I think it's something of the order of between 30 and 40, I should say. Hmm.
Mainly in areas that you're interested in, though. I mean, you didn't supervise on, as it were, Japan, or...
Yes.
You later became interested in Japan.
I did, yes, interested in Japan. Mm. But I supervised in all sorts of areas. I was very lucky in with the graduate students who I had. Mm. You know, entirely luck. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, the ones who I thought were good, I sought out. Mm. And vice versa, I think. Mm. You know, and, but very varied ones. And so I've had supervised people work in Japan. Mm. Supervised people work in the Philippines. I've been always interested in Southeast Asia because mm. of Madagascar. Mm. I mean, that's similar. Malaysia. Mm. Also, you know, this is linked with the holes that there were at LSE, different kinds. Mm. South America and the Andes, which is an area I was also interested in. I don't know why. I mean, I do. Mm. I am still very interested in it. Obviously, Madagascar. China.
You supervised on China.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, it's sort of...
Later, LSE had Charles Stafford and...
Well, I supervised him.
Did you?
Yes.
Hmm. He was one of your students?
Yes. Hmm. There are four of them, one of them are my students in LSE.
Who are they?
There's Charles, there's Fenella.
Fenella Canal.
Richard Stuti. Catherine Allison.
Are there other students who you particularly admired or have gone on to do interesting?
Oh yes, a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, David Lang was one of my first students, graduate students. Joel Kahn, America.
Quite a few.
I had a lot to do with the supervision of Olivia Harris, even though she wasn't a supervisor for complicated reasons. I'm just trying to. I mean, if I sort of think around, Michael Stewart.
He was one of your students.
Yes. Janet Carston, Sophie Day.
You've left a large legacy.
Yeah, I mean, a lot in Britain and a lot abroad as well. Got lots of, so yeah.
You enjoyed?
Olivia Watson.
The PhD supervising. Did you enjoy, did you do much undergraduate supervision teaching?
Yes.
Did you enjoy that as well?
I liked lecturing very much, yes. Yes, I have more difficulty in sort of in what would be called in Cambridge supervision with undergraduates. I don't with graduates, but I don't think they understand me very well. I get a bit bored.
But lecturing, do you lecture? Well, we'll see tonight, but I mean, this is later on in your life. But do you lecture from detailed? You read out lectures, did you?
No, I don't. What I tend to do, I mean, that's not what I'll be doing tonight because this is a student society, so I'll try to just be very, very general. But I like to sort of write a lot and then just write notes from which I lecture. But I've written much more before. And I like lecturing on new things, on new topics. Because, I mean, lecturing is, like supervising graduate students, is one of the ways in which I sort of think forward and learn new things.
So quite a lot of the ideas in your lectures go into your other writings?
Yes. They're sort of places of trying to work things out. As well as the interaction with the graduate students. I mean, in the sense that I get things from them.
What about the other part of one's life as an academic, the administration?
I hate.
You hate.
I mean, I ran the department. I was quite pleased. I became convener of the department for quite a long period.
Did you?
Yeah, almost 9 years, in fact. And I think I will put that, did a pretty good job in terms of that, in that I renewed the department very much, you know, I mean, with the help of other people. And that was very much, a lot of it was luck. You know, people going and the ability to bring in new, exciting people. You know, and I felt, you know, that there was a period when the LSE really picked up again, which was that period.
When were you convener? Between about
81 and 92. Probably started in towards the end of the 1980s. Well, I'm not quite sure exactly. But it was more or less from the end of the 1980s. 80s to the middle of the 1990s. And, you know, the department was exciting. I mean, it was a really exciting period, partly because there was Alfred there, there was Johnny, there was Chris. We had very, very good graduate students like Richard Stuti, like Fenella, like David Lang, like, I mean, I felt, you know, it was a real high point And I felt that when I'd been an undergraduate department, it had just been very, very good, and then there was a sort of low point. Picked up again, I hope it carries on. I think it was still very good, you know, until recently. I mean, recently we don't know what the future is going to be, obviously.
Can I just ask you about, I mean, there's a whole assembly of your theories. There's the first field work, there's the Marxism, there's the work on language and oratory, there's work on violence, there's work on memory. If you had to sort of pick out one or two highlights from what you've achieved in your thinking, what would you pick out?
Well, in terms of the writing, I mean, I would sort of say just probably a series of articles, first of all, the past and the present and the present, and then that article on symbol, song and dance. And then more recently, the work on memory, the work on the article on cognitive science and anthropology, which I did. And then the book, I think From Blessing to Violence is unusual and interesting book. Perhaps, you know, the latest article I have done, which is this thing on religion, and it's not really about religion, it's about, it kind of takes an evolutionary look at the nature of social organisation, just come out in the Royal Society of Proceedings.
Yes, I read the science, New Scientist, I think.
Oh, yeah, well, that's a bit unfortunate. I've had that, yeah. But I mean, you read the article, the actual article. This is rather different.
Because it made it rather oversimplified.
Yes.
What is the argument seemed to be, well, it's a bit better if you tell me what.
The argument is that most of the work on the evolution of the social seems to think of it as a sort of gradual continuation of complexification. But that is thinking of the social in much too straightforward a way, because the human social involves what one might call a level of imagination, which is that of roles separate from individuals, groups which have an imaginary existence apart from any kind of empirical existence. And if one thinks of the so, and that element is a new phenomena, which is not continuous with the social organization of other primates. There's no trace of that in any other, among any other primates. It dissolves the religious, because the religion stops being a subject. Since one realizes that an aspect of human social is just the same as the religious. So, you know, it's a mistake to try to look for explanations, evolutionary explanations of religion. One needs to look for evolutionary explanations of a much wider phenomena, which includes what we call religious, but that's not an analytically useful term. And that, to a certain extent, this probably should be explained partially in terms of a capacity to imagine possible worlds, and that our social involves the imagination of possible worlds, which are a kind of game on those which seem more intuitive. And that's not specific to religion, it's general to human society.
And it's something that children are particularly...
Yes, that's what I'm going to talk about. I mean, I'm going to talk about it very loosely, but then children begin to do that very early. I think that's very key.
I mean, obviously in the moment when people start talking about imagined communities, one thinks of Benedict Anderson. Is there any overlap with?
Well, there's a bit of an overlap. I mean, you know, the point that that communities are imagined entities, I suppose, is fairly.
It's much older than that.
It's much older than Benedict Anderson.
Actually, in Tocqueville, among others.
Yeah, I mean, and that it's linked, you know, the specific mechanisms which Anderson says created it don't entirely convince me. I mean, sort of print thing and so on, don't seem to be very necessary for this.
No. It must have existed before print. Well before.
Well, that's the point, yes.
About 50,000 years ago,
yes.
As you point out. Your overlap between anthropology and cognitive science reminds me of someone who was up here for 7 or 8 years, Pascal Boyer. Do you know?
I knew him very well.
Mm.
And we have a lot of overlap of views, but a lot of differences as well.
Mm.
I think, you know, the difference of. I mean, you know, we share a lot, but the big difference, if you like, is that Pascal, a bit like Dan Sperber, thinks of certain elements that one could discover in cultures as fixed because they have an innate basis. Now, I'm quite convinced about the business about the innate basis, but anything that comes from an innate basis is inevitably churned up, transformed, you know, through the historical and cultural process. And therefore looking for bits of pure, uncultural elements seems to me to be misguided. And that's the fundamental difference.
I suddenly realised when I was talking, of course, he wrote a book called The Invention of Religion or something.
Yes, he did. And I mean, to a certain extent, that article is basically a criticism, the one you were referring to as his work. In fact, I mean, his work is just an elaboration of ideas which Dan Sperber had set out earlier.
We've covered a tiny part of your life and work. Is there any other large area which I should have asked you about? Bookbinding?
Yes, I'm a bookbinder. I am a qualified bookbinder.
Yes, I remember you talking to my wife, Sarah, about that. She still does a bit of binding.
I went through the courses at the College of Printing. I'm not doing very much now, but I did enjoy that very much. I quite enjoy sort of crafts.
Craft activities.
Yes.
So there's nothing that you would like to put on record that I've.
Of great importance.
Time for families.
Yes.
Children.
I have children.
What children do you have?
I have a son and a daughter. And grandchildren.
Has observing them been helpful in your?
Yes, I mean, I've been very interested in child development. One very important point, one thing that has been missed out, or I don't know if it has been missed out, is that I have benefited a lot from working with people like Susan Carey. Who's a developmental psychologist and also, I think, a brilliant sort of thinker. I've benefited a hell of a lot from Dan Sperber. Paul Harris, who's another psychologist. These people I find much more exciting than many anthropologists in many ways, because I do think of anthropology as ultimately a sort of natural science. And therefore, I am sort of more in contact with them, in a sense, while I find a lot of other work in social sciences now sort of involved with what I call sort of dissecting shadows.
You're referring to the cultural term and postmodernism and things like this, or
yes, and other yes.
such things.
Yes. I'm very much a philosophically a naturalist, like Danzberger, and that sets us apart, really. Very fundamentally, actually.
I think that's probably a very nice point to end. Thank you very much indeed, Maurice.